Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1148. The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy, Part 3. This is being recorded on August 27th of the year 2020. As I am speaking, the Republican Convention is winding up. And I am sorry to say that I think Donald Trump's campaign is getting off on the right foot, but not in Charlotte, North Carolina, or Washington, D.C., but in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Bear in mind that 69% of registered voters in the U.S. are non-Hispanic whites. And in the context of COVID-19, part of the Paperclip Legacy. Paperclip, by the way, refers to Project Paperclip, the incorporation of the cream of the Third Reich's National Security Establishment or National Security Scientific Establishment into ours at the end, at the end of World War II, but the arrangements were made during the war itself. This, really, I can't call it a pandemic because it is a plandemic, P-L-A-N-D-E-M-I-C. It is intended, and the right-wing agenda in so many ways is being realized by this. But I have referred to the series that I've been doing as Bio-Psyop Apocalypse. And it is destabilizing human beings on an individual and social basis. They are terrified of something they can't see, the virus, and something they can see only too clearly, economic destruction. It is causing people to experience depression and other psychological afflictions, seek comfort or escape through substance abuse. Domestic violence is on the upswing. I would also note that police are human, and no doubt they are experiencing the same thing. Britain made it illegal for people who don't live together to have sex. Major cities in the U.S., including L.A. and New York, have encouraged people to masturbate. Put that one into the books. But tickle yourself for peace. That's P-E-A-C-E, by the way. And again, people are not thinking in terms of altruism. They are thinking in terms of, I'm scared, I am hurting, and I want somebody to help me. And that generally works in favor of reaction. However, although we are talking about events that took place during and immediately after World War II, this has the most profound implications for the Republican Party, which is inextricably linked with the events that we are talking about. I'm going to jump right back in with the article that we have been reading. It is from Covert, almost, it's about 35 years old, almost. It is from Covert Action Quarterly, number 25, from the winter of 1986, and it is by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott. It is titled, How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other. And it is about just exactly that. Recall that Alan Dulles became head of the CIA under Eisenhower at the same time as his fellow Nazi collaborator and fellow Sullivan and Cromwell attorney, John Foster Dulles, became Secretary of State. And what they presided over was literally the Nazification of America's institutions. And what we are seeing today is the outgrowth of that. In the concluding portion of our program, we're going to take a look at William Casey, a very important fellow who, as Ronald Reagan's CIA director, set up the intelligence fronts that are involved with many of the covert actions against China, part of which is the coronavirus. That virus does not come from China. It comes from here, and it is realizing the right-wing agenda in so many ways. It is a wealth-concentrating virus. It is crushing both public schools and university education, crushing public transit, devastating people people of color, crushing state and local governments. Libraries are closed. Nonprofits are being crushed. It is doing what they want. It is literally the entire right-wing Republican wet dream made manifest. And the roots of that, however, are in Project Paperclip. Now, we have been talking about, in this article, about Josef Mengele, the infamous angel of death of Auschwitz, who appears to have been one of the people who, although not necessarily in the U.S., went to work alongside of and in cooperation with the U.S. as part of the events that we are talking about. So again, plunging right back in, how Alan Dulles and the SS preserved each other by Peter Dale Scott from a covert action quarterly number 25 from the winter of 1986. And I'm going to overlap this with the text that we have read in our last program. And this is the thesis statement for what we are dealing with. In dealing with the SS, Alan Dulles and OSS Chief William Donovan knew that this risky operation could easily backfire against the OSS, whose organizational future had already been challenged by J. Edgar Hoover and traditionalists in U.S. military intelligence. But they also knew that just as the OSS was the best hope for the survival of the SS cadres, so in a sense, these cadres were the highest trump card in the impending contest for the OSS's own institutional survival and evolution into the contemporary CIA. What ultimately persuaded Harry Truman in 1947 to authorize an operational CIA was, in fact, partly the need to find an institutional home for the post-war Galen organization. In 1948, Alan Dulles, by now a civilian, helped write the memo persuading Truman to take on the Galen organization on Galen's own terms. One of these was that Galen would continue to work with his old OSS liaison, Frank Wisner, chosen by Dulles rather than Army Intelligence, parenthetically, just as John Foster and Alan Dulles were key Wall Street attorneys from Sullivan and Cromwell. Frank Wisner had worked for Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn, which was the general counsel for the Dow Jones Corporation, which used to own the New York Stock Exchange. At one point, Harbing Jackson, as well as Frank Wisner, both alumni of Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn, were deputy directors of Central Intelligence. Continuing, could Josef Mengele, not even a political policeman like Walter Rauf and Klaus Barbie, but a doctor with a penchant for lethal experiments on human beings, could even Mengele have been saved as a result of a secret deal between Dulles and the SS? Such a hypothesis would once have been almost unthinkable, but we have since been told that his colleague, that is Mengele's colleague in the Auschwitz human experiments, Walter Schreiber, was shielded by the Americans from a Polish conviction in absentia so that he could help guide the post-war researchers of the U.S. Air Force in bacteriological warfare. In 1952, Schreiber was helped by American officials to reestablish himself via Argentina in Paraguay. That is the year that Mengele himself appeared in Argentina, moving to Paraguay himself 2 years later. In 1981, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists revealed that Mengele's equivalent in Japan, Dr. Shiro Ishii, as well as his assistants, had been granted immunity by the U.S. in exchange for exclusive access to their researches in chemical and bacteriological warfare. This, despite the fact that Americans had been among the more than 3,000 prisoners of war and civilians killed in the course of their treatment as human guinea pigs. A Soviet war crimes trial in 1949 based on these experiments was denounced at the time by the U.S. as a simple exercise in propaganda. that Mengele's escape and immunity were arranged by the U.S. like those of Schreiber and so many others will seem more probable once we have studied the incredible post-war careers of Klaus Barbie, Friedrich Schwend, and Walter Rauff. But before doing so, we must glance forward to the ways in which Mengele's post-war career has overlapped with those of these other SS murderers, whom we now know to have benefited from U.S. protection. Despite the books, articles, and TV programs about Mengele, the angel of death at Auschwitz, less is known for certain about his post-war activities than those of any comparable war criminal. Apart from his extended residence in Paraguay, where he gained citizenship in 1957 and was stripped of it in 1979, little has been documented. But in one of the best books to appear about the post-war network of Rauff, Schwend, and Mengele, the so-called Kameradenwerk, the career of Mengele is closely implicated. The book is The Bormann Brotherhood by William Stevenson, Stevenson, himself a wartime intelligence operative with access to intelligence sources, including the records of William Donovan and their mutual friend Sir William Stevenson of the British SOE. That is, by the way, is the Special Operations Executive, sort of like the spec op troops of our own national security establishment. By the way, although the name is the same, this Stevenson, the of intrepid fame, is capital S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S-O-N, the author of the Bormann Brotherhood, S-T-E-V as in Victor, E-N-S-O-N. Continuing. According to Stevenson, Mengele had worked in a restricted military zone of Paraguay with the wartime Croatian dictator Ante Pavelić, whose Croatian Catholic connections undoubtedly, as we shall see, played central roles in the escapes of Rauff, Schwend, and Barbie. Pavelić had initially made contact with the Latin American Nazi Kameradenwerk through Rauff. With respect to Mengele's finances, Stevenson mentions the Kameradenwerk representative in Ecuador, quote, Alphonse Sassen, S-A-S-S-E-N, the representative of the Brotherhood or Kameradenwerk business enterprise known as Estrella. It is said, too, that Sassen is financed by Dr. Josef Mengele, who now controls such funds as remain liquid from the sale of European loot. This is important, since such post-war SS funds had earlier been administered by Friedrich Schwend, who had used them, apparently with U.S. connivance and support, for the exfiltration of himself and other top SS members. Schwend apparently ceased to play this role after he and a band of Croatians under his control were exposed in the 1972 Peruvian murder scandal in which Mengele was a suspect. Sassen, a Dutch SS officer and a convicted war criminal, is chiefly remembered for his extended record of Eichmann's revelations to him in 1957, which formed a major exhibit in the Eichmann trial. Stevenson elsewhere names this Estrella company as the subsidiary of a financial consortium controlled from Bolivia by Schwend's business partner, Klaus Barbie. In the early 1960s, Barbie did, in fact, and again, quoting from the Bormann Brotherhood, actually not quoting from the Bormann Brotherhood, but another book, The Nazi Legacy, Klaus Barbie and the International Fascist Connection, set up a company called Estrella, ostensibly dealing, actually, let me read the whole sentence here for continuity. In the early 1960s, Barbie did, in fact, set up a company called Estrella, ostensibly dealing in quinquina bark, although no records exist in the public registry in La Paz, at least one Bolivian arms dealer still remembers it as a weapons trading company. It appears that Barbie and Estrella did export quinquina bark as agents for the German drug firm Boehringer, which grew rich on quinine contracts to the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. But the primary business of Barbie and Schwend was arms trafficking. And Peter Dale Scott splices in a direct quote, carried on through two German-based firms, Merex, M-E-R-E-X, and Gemetex, G-E-M-E-T-E-X. The two Nazis acted as agents, negotiating purchases not only on behalf of the Bolivian and Peruvian governments, but through their friendship with the Nazi Hans Ulrich Trudel, sales to Paraguay and Chile, and through Otto Skorzeny in Spain, further deals in Madrid. Then Peter goes on to write, Merex AG, itself set up in 1963, was an arms company owned and controlled by the Galen BND, while Skorzeny was one of the top go-betweens in the post-war deals between Galen, the SS, and the CIA. Otto Skorzeny, of course, SS colonel, and the focal point of AFA program number 22. Merex, by the way, was one of the many companies used in some of the Iran-Contra arms transfers, as we looked at in the AFA program number 32, among others. Continuing. Barbie's arms deals, concerted in this way with Western intelligence, were politically influential as well as economically lucrative. They involved him, according to French sources, in the drug trafficking business of Auguste Joseph Ricord, R-I-C-O-R-D, a Corsican Nazi collaborator who, like Mengele, was established with high-level connections in Paraguay. It was apparently the Nixon administration's determination to break the Ricord ring, which first made the CIA begin reporting on Mengele's own involvement in the drug traffic. Like his fellow escapee, Klaus Barbie, in Bolivia, Mengele was an old man who began to lose some of his political immunity in Latin America. But the well-placed networks, which over the years enabled him to cross frontiers without detection, are still in place, still politically influential throughout the continent of Latin America. It remains important to understand that network more clearly in order to neutralize as far as possible its evident support in Washington itself. Bear in mind, again, this was published in the winter of 1986. Continuing, the next section of this article, the U.S. protection of Klaus Barbie. Of course, Klaus Barbie, the infamous butcher of Lyon, Gestapo chief in Lyon, France, during World War II, is well known to members, veteran listeners to this program. Like his fellow escapee Klaus Barbie in Bolivia, Mengele was an old man who began to lose some of his political immunity in Latin America. But the well-placed networks which over the years enabled him to cross frontiers without detection are still in place, still politically influential throughout the continent of Latin America. It remains important to understand that network more clearly in order to neutralize as far as possible its evident support in Washington itself. A brief glance at the post-war career of Klaus Barbie shows how relatively small a role in his prosperity was played by post-war Nazi cabals such as the well-publicized Odessa or Die Spinne. Condemned to death by the French for genocidal murders in Lyon, Barbie was concealed and protected for 4 years in Germany by the U.S. Army's Counterintelligence Corps, which was using him as an informant to spy on, ironically, the French, After the communists were dropped from General de Gaulle's cabinet, the Nazi Barbie was reassigned to spy on the America houses set up by the U.S. State Department, which were, according to Barbie's American handler, stocked with all kinds of left-wing literature. Barbie's reports may thus have helped fuel the attack on this program 5 years later by Joe McCarthy, whose charges against the State Department were based on documents leaked to him by a source in Army intelligence. By the way, interrupting briefly, that was almost certainly the late John Frenchy Grombach, who in turn was passing intelligence to Joe McCarthy that was generated by the Pond. That was a group of SS officers who were headed up by Himmler's personal adjutant, General Karl Wolf. And I would note, if this seems like to perhaps younger listeners, like you know, a long time ago and far away, Joe McCarthy's top counsel was Roy Cohn, who was the political mentor to and counsel for Donald Trump. Continuing. As a mere policeman and persecutor of Jews, Barbie was not a candidate for the headquarters staff of the revamped Galen organization, which was being transformed with CIA money and oversight into West Germany's post-war Galen intelligence agency, the BND. Barbie's future would thus be less comfortable than that of his fellow CIC informant Emil Augsburg, who had worked directly under Eichmann on the SS final solution to the Jewish problem, unquote. Despite post-war stories that Augsburg had been saved from punishment by Odessa and the Vatican, we now know that Augsburg went, quote, at once, unquote, from Barbie's CIC unit into the Galen organization to staff the offensive special forces against the Soviet Union being promoted by the CIA's Alan Dulles and Frank Wisner. Augsburg was teamed with Dr. Franz Alfred Siecks, whose 26-year sentence for ordering the executions of hundreds of Jews at Smolensk in the Soviet Union was commuted to time served by John J. McCloy, the U.S. High Commissioner of Germany. Smolensk, S-M-O-L-E-N-S-K. Continuing, this is called Barbie's Escape and the Ryan Cover-Up. But the High Commissioner of Germany was eventually unable to stall the more and more strident French demands for delivery of Barbie as a convicted war criminal. In 1951, the CIC provided Barbie with a package of false documents, funds, and references for his new identity as Klaus Altmann, unquote, and sent him to Genoa down an underground railway, the infamous Rat Line, which the Austrian Counterintelligence Corps had been operating for 4 years. By the way, we went into this at great length in AFA program number 17. Continuing. Barbie was received in Genoa by the Croatian priest Dr. Krunoslav Draganovic, Draganovic, an advisor to the wartime Croatian dictatorship of Ante Pavelic. Draganovic was an admitted member of the wartime Ustaši terrorist organization in Croatia, which Pavelic had used to carry out a genocidal extermination of the Orthodox Serbs in his puppet Catholic dictatorship. Through his Vatican and Latin American connections, Draganovic had exfiltrated a number of wanted Ustaši war criminals, including almost certainly Pavelic himself. The CIC knew all of this, yet found Draganovic, whom they considered to be himself a war criminal, useful. A 1983 Justice Department investigation of the Barbie case by Alan A. Ryan treats the U.S. Army's exfiltration of Barbie, handled at the time as a high-priority intelligence matter, as the solution to a disposal problem, a means of making a potential embarrassment vanish. Ryan's report is critical of CIC's decisions and gross lies in this period, but manages with a skill that perhaps only lawyers are capable of to exculpate the cover-up in other branches of the U.S. government as the innocent transmittal of CIC's misrepresentations. Again, CIC is the Army Counterintelligence Corps. Continuing. Ryan is particularly concerned to dispel the impression, which he admits was shared by several of Barbie's CIC handlers, that the CIC ever had any interest in Barbie. Ryan's documentation, however, shows evidence of a conscious, coordinated cover-up of the Barbie case at a much higher level of the U.S. government than the benighted CIC. Ryan himself notes instances when senior officials in the High Commissioner of Germany's office in internal memos contradicted their own assurances of an active search for Barbie and revealed the existence of what he calls unofficial information, unquote, or back channels, refuting their assurances. Even more striking is the widespread bureaucratic habit at high levels of EUCOM, the U.S. military command in Europe, the High Commissioner of Germany, and the Paris U.S. Embassy of translating statements from the press or internal memos about Barbie, that's spelled B-A-R-B-I-E, into misleading interagency communications about a non-existent Barbier, B-A-R-B-I-E-R. Observers of the FBI and CIA will recognize this behavior, which can be used to withhold files about Barbier when pressed under the Freedom of Information Act to disclose files on Barbie. Ryan further notes the disappearance of many documents, including all those in the Barbie file at the time of his exfiltration, before the file was microfilmed several weeks later. This does not, however, deter him from the lawyerly conclusion that Barbie did not have a relationship with any other U.S. government agency at this time on the ground that, quote, there is no evidence in Barbie's CIC dossier that he worked at any time for any agency other than the CIC. This investigation has established that, had the situation been otherwise, the CIC dossier would have reflected it. The weakness in this logic is also apparent at the words, quote, any agency, unquote, where he ought to have written, quote, any U.S. agency, unquote. Ryan's report here and throughout significantly fails to address the possibility that the U.S. was reestablishing Barbie, who also called himself Klaus Altman in Latin America, as a future asset of the rapidly growing Galen organization, then still funded entirely by the U.S. Ryan's avoidance of this hypothesis is so disingenuous in itself as to corroborate it. Again, quoting, apart from the CIA, there is no other agency, with the possible exception of the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, and then P.B.L. Scott adds, the earliest name of the CIA component authorized to carry out covert activities, I would point out that was headed up by the aforementioned Frank Wisner, that would have had any connection with Barbie's activities. This investigation had yielded no hint or suggestion, let alone evidence, however fragmentary, that the OPC had any knowledge of or involvement with Klaus Barbie, the Merknet, or other activities described in this report. In evaluating this statement, we have to remember that OPC, under its aggressive chief Frank Wisner, was funding and recruiting for the Galen organization. This last sentence again. In evaluating this statement, we have to remember that OPC, under its aggressive chief, Frank Wisner, was funding and recruiting for the Galen organization. We also need to remember that the CIC's MERTnet, of which Barbie was part, had established contact with the Galen organization, which had tried to recruit Kurt Merk as its chief of counterintelligence operations. That by March of 1948, CIC had established liaison with the CIA in Europe because of the latter's interest in the MERTnet. This was 3 months before the creation of OPC in June of 1948, but the interest of Dulles and Wisner in Galen went back to 1945. That Emil Augsburg, another member of the CIC's MERTnet, had been, quote, dropped, unquote, like Barbie, and at once recruited by the Galen organization. That CIC, in securing false documentation in the name of Altman for Barbie, told the CIC office to explain that, again quoting, subject is of extreme interest to U.S. intelligence and is traveling on highly sensitive task. Also, the CIC is taking current action in behalf of another U.S. agency. Ryan's studied avoidance of the possibility that Barbie was dispatched to the Galen organization is the more eloquent when we recall that this charge was made in detailed fashion by William Stevenson in the Borman Brotherhood. By far, the most authoritative treatment of the Barbie case in any American book before the Ryan Report. And then, quoting the Borman Brotherhood, Klaus Barbie was a man adroit enough to get on the American payroll of the West German Intelligence Agency when it was run by General Galen. Killers had escaped by selling their talents to the intelligence agencies of East and West. Klaus Barbie had worked for Import-Export Agency at Schillerstrasse 38 in Augsburg. Such fronts are the favored fronts of spy rings. This one had been operated by the Galen organization. And then Professor Scott continues, Ryan's documents confirmed that in 1947, Barbie was working at 38 Schillerstrasse, Kempton, rather than Augsburg. Ryan notes that a search for him there 2 years later, quote, proved fruitless, unquote. Ryan later translates this predictable fruitlessness of the belated inquiry into the undocumented statement that, quote, Barbie had never been, quote, on Schillerstrasse, unquote. This is not a persuasive rebuttal of Stevenson's claim. Finally, one can hardly ignore the fact that the protection and exfiltration of Barbie were handled at the top and at the bottom by the U.S. hierarchy, by men with OSS, OPC, and CIA connections. George Negoy, M-E-A-G-O-Y, the Austrian CIC agent who secured Barbie's false documentation and would personally deliver him through Austria to Father Boganovich in Genoa, Italy, was himself about to enter the CIA. At the High Commission of Germany's office, the preparation of misleading reassurances to the French was being handled by John Bross, B-R-O-S-S, a veteran of OSS paramilitary operations who in April of 1951 would join the Eastern Europe Division of OPC, working closely with the Galen organization. A resolution of what, quote, other agency, unquote, picked up Barbie in 1951 would be of great help in understanding the post-war career of Josef Mengele. For there is no doubt at all that in Latin America, Barbie became part of an international intelligence network working directly with proprietaries of Galen's BND, and little doubt that Mengele was intimately connected to this network as well. Next, the Barbie Kameradenwerk in Latin America. The unlikely possibility implied by Ryan that Barbie, with his store of embarrassing secrets, was left to start a new future on his own has been refuted by Barbie himself. though Ryan asserts that Barbie was the only Nazi to be exfiltrated by CIC down the rat line. Barbie himself recalls that the other occupants of his general hotel, quote, were all Nazi fugitives, among them Eichmann himself, unquote. According to Barbie, Dragunovich told him his reasons, quote, were purely humanitarian. He helped both Catholics and Protestants, but mostly they were SS officers, about 200 in all, anti-communists. He said to me, quote, we've got to keep up a sort of reserve on which we can draw in the future. I think that was the Vatican's motive as well, unquote. Indeed, the Vatican did have a program underway for the exfiltration of anti-communists. This was the work of Bishop Alois Hubal, H-U-B-A-L, of the Collegium Teutonicum, a priest close to both Pius XII and the future Paul VI, as well as a public admirer of the Third Reich. After an interview in Rome with former Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller, Hubal had begun the work of supplying Vatican documentation for such prominent fugitives as Müller, that's Heinrich Müller, head of the Gestapo, and the security director for the Deadly Bormann organization, Eichmann, and perhaps Martin Bormann himself. One more time. After an interview in Rome with former Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller, Hubal had begun the work supplying Vatican documentation for such prominent fugitives as Müller himself, Eichmann, and perhaps Martin Bormann. It was Hubal who gave Father Dragunovich the necessary introductions to the International Red Cross and other, quote, officials who, for a bribe, could smooth the fugitives' path, unquote. Between them, Hubal and Dragunovich helped hundreds of Nazis to escape, and perhaps thousands of Croatian Ustaši. Chief of these was the former Croatian dictator Ante Pavelić. According to William Stevenson, quote, Pavelić had since withdrawn into an armed camp in Paraguay shared with German settlers in their restricted military zone northeast of Asunción. There, he worked with Dr. Josef Mengele, the death camp experimenter, and Walter Rauch, who designed and built gassing chambers for Auschwitz. The most prominent Nazi known to have escaped by this route established a network in Latin America, often in alliance with Croatian cohorts, somewhat as follows. Bolivia, Klaus Barbie with Croatians. Peru, Friedrich Schwend with Croatians. Chile, Walter Rauch with Croatians. Ecuador, Alphonse Sasson. Argentina, Otto Skorzeny, Hans Ulrich Rudel, and Heinrich Müller. This network, the so-called Kameradenwerk, has maintained close political, social, and business ties. By most accounts, Josef Mengele was its leading representative in Paraguay. Two American led the Mexico Operation Bernhard, Schwend, and the U.S. Army. Two American books by authors with wartime intelligence careers have conditioned us to accept the debatable hypothesis that Martin Bormann, Hitler's deputy and head of the Nazi party bureaucracy, was the central organizing figure in this network. On surer ground, they point to the role of the extensive post-war assets collected or plundered by the SS and Bormann. This came from three sources: the proceeds from the SS forgery of British pound notes, Operation Bernhard, the looting of Jews and other Nazi victims, and most significantly, the corporate contributions to a special fund set up to guarantee the survival of German multinationals abroad after the impending collapse of Hitler. Soon after the war, The OSS found the extensive documentation of a meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944, to establish this fund between representatives of the SS, the Nazi Party, and firms like Krupp, IG Farben, and Messerschmitt. But as the Cold War encouraged the U.S. to see the German corporate presence in Latin America in a more friendly light, the role of these firms in providing new careers for war criminals abroad was ignored. In fact, it was the key to the post-war status of the Kameraden. Otto Skorzeny, acquitted of his criminal charges by the intervention of Western intelligence, became a sales representative of Krupp. Hans Ulrich Rudel, never charged but an unrepentant Nazi ideologue in the post-war era, became a sales representative of Siemens. Walter Rauf, designer of the gas ovens at Auschwitz and the mobile gas chambers, found his first employment in Latin America with a subsidiary of IG Farben, an employer of the slave labor at Auschwitz. Franz Paul Stangl, S-T-A-N-G-L, chief of the Treblinka extermination camp, found post-war employment in Latin America with Volkswagen, as did Eichmann with Mercedes-Benz, and so on. But U.S. intelligence may have played a more direct role in the exfiltration of Nazis with the proceeds of Operation Bernhard, the SS forgery of British pound notes. Here again, Western intelligence knew enough about Operation Bernhard to protect the post-war pound by the British government's timely issue of new notes and recall of the old. But by this time, much of the SS profits, an estimated $300 million worth, by the way, that's at the end of World War II, that's a lot of money, beginning again. By this time, much of the SS profits, an estimated $300 million worth, had been converted to genuine currency. Most of this money has never been traced. The two men in charge of laundering the forged banknotes was freed of, The man in charge of laundering the forged banknotes was Friedrich Schwend, who in 1945 and 1946 in North Italy became an important link in setting up the SS escape route to the Vatican. Aftermath author Ladislaus Farrago narrates in detail how Heinrich Müller was driven in Schwend's chauffeured Mercedes from Murano, North Italy, to Rome, where he was deposited at a Croatian seminary and made his historic contact with Bishop Udall. From documents found in Schwend's possession in 1972, he reports that, quote, "The bulk of the money the Bishop Udall needed was placed at his disposal by a financier named Friedrich Freddy Mercer, M-E-R-S-E-R, partner of Friedrich Schwend in Operation Bernhard. The money came from the hoard Schwend had amassed in Swiss accounts." The money came from the hoard Schwend had amassed in Swiss accounts by the exchange of counterfeit pounds for hard currency. This whole passage again. "The bulk of the money Bishop Udall needed was placed at his disposal by a financier named Friedrich Freddy Mercer, partner of Friedrich Schwend in Operation Bernhard. The money came from the hoard Schwend had amassed in Swiss accounts by the exchange of counterfeit pounds for hard currency." What you will not learn from Farrago's and Stevenson's accounts is that in 1945 and 1946, when Schwend was playing this crucial role in setting up the rat line, Schwend was working for American intelligence. Again, quoting from the Nazi legacy, U.S. documents reveal that after passing into the hands of the 44th Counterintelligence Corps Detachment, he was used as an informant by American intelligence agencies in Austria, the Austrian Tyrol, and Milan in North Italy. And next is a discussion of Alan Dulles and the aforementioned Karl Wolf, Himmler's personal adjutant. And this, by the way, in the further record show called Darkness Before Sunrise, this is spoken about in some detail. Continuing. These long-suppressed details about the post-war U.S. sponsorship of the wanted war criminals Barbie and Schwind confirm the recent accusations of John Loftus that the SS Kameraden were exfiltrated as a result of Operation Sunrise, the secret agreement shortly before VE Day between Alan Dulles of OSS Bern and SS General Karl Wolff. As recorded in Dulles's and other establishment accounts, Operation Sunrise concerned the surrender of Nazi troops into Italy to prevent the needless destruction of civilian property and help forestall a takeover of North Italy by the communist partisans in the area. More recently, revisionist historians have focused on the degree to which Dulles and Wolff, the principal negotiators, exceeded their authorization to negotiate and in so doing created a major political rift between Stalin and Churchill. Roosevelt, by the way, was aware of this and was talking about some of the contradictions. He conveniently died in April of 1945. I have long suspected that he was murdered. By the way, in the next section, note how the contacts through Alan Dulles and Karl Wolff with the milieu of the Galen organization proceed by months. The official contacts between the official historical record of the contacts between the Galen organization and U.S. Intel. Continuing with Peter Dale Scott's account. Inasmuch as the armistice in North Italy only preceded that in the rest of Europe by 1 week, Operation Sunrise may have had less impact on the outcome of the war than on the survival of the cadres of the SS. One of the principal SS participants in the negotiation was Milan Gestapo chief Walter Rauf, soon to be a fugitive through the Kameradenwerk. And then quoting from an article. According to John Loftus, a promise by Dulles of amnesty for SS negotiators led him, Dulles, to exploit his connections at the Vatican to smuggle war criminals to South America. Rauf was set up 1 month after the armistice in Genoa, where under cover of a Vatican-run refugee relief organization, he reportedly sent off some 5,000 Gestapo and SS agents over a 4-year period. Among them was Klaus Barbie. On April 27th, 1945, after being visited by Dulles' OSS agent Emilio Daddario, D-A-D-D-A-R-I-O in Milan, Rauf surrendered to Army CIC. According to recently declassified American intelligence documents seen by Loftus, quote, he told Army CIC, that is to say Rauf, that he had made arrangements, unquote, for his surrender, quote, in order to avoid further bloodshed in Milan. The arrangements could be confirmed, quote, by Hussmann, i.e. Max Hussmann, a Swiss participant in Sunrise, and Mr. Dulles, both Allied agents in Switzerland. Later, Rauf told his interrogators how, quote, he himself had been the go-between in negotiating the secret surrender to the SS armies in Italy. He described how he went to Lugano in March of 1945 to arrange the release of Allied prisoners in Rauf's custody as a sign of good faith. In return for the surrender of all SS forces, Dulles promised that none of the negotiators would ever be prosecuted as war criminals. Unquote. Loftus then confirms the claim of Beata Klarsfeld that Rauf began to work for Dulles and to exfiltrate Nazis through Catholic monasteries while on the OSS payroll. Quote, despite the U.S. Army interrogators' pleas that Walter Ralph, quote, is considered a menace if ever set free, and failing actual elimination, i.e. killed, is recommended for lifelong internment, unquote. Dulles kept his bargain, and Walter Ralph was released. According to usually reliable intelligence sources, Dulles then employed Ralph on anti-communist operations in Italy, which was Ralph's specialty under the Nazis. Dulles asked the Vatican to continue his wartime arrangement of using Catholic monasteries and convents to hide OSS agents. After the war, Dulles explained, these safe houses were still needed to smuggle out anti-communist refugees. The Vatican's involvement with Dulles' program was minimal. The church provided food, shelter, and identity cards, as it did to all refugees. And Loftus's next observation is more than important. It was Alan Dulles' contacts, not the Vatican, who handled the smuggling of Nazis. According to top secret State Department documents, the Italian police provided the false passports for Allied agents. The visas came from the Argentine consulate in the Allied intelligence unit based at Trieste, and the embarkation paperwork was handled by a U.S. State Department officer in Genoa. Genoa, incidentally, was Ralph's area of jurisdiction. All of them worked for Alan Dulles, who set up the unwitting Vatican to be the scapegoat if it were ever discovered that Dulles' anti-communist refugees were really SS intelligence agents. To be sure, there were a few priests and even one bishop who smuggled a few of their own Nazi countrymen through Italy. This must allude to the Croatians. But that was at extremely low levels of the Vatican and was quietly squelched after the exposure in the Italian press in 1948. The higher level connections between the Vatican and Dulles, the higher level connection between the Vatican and Dulles is still classified by the government, unquote. And then Peter Dale Scott goes on to add, Loftus's remarkable charges against Dulles are corroborated by scraps of the public record. In his semi-authorized history of the OSS, R. Harris Smith notes that the leading Italian go-between in the negotiations, the industrialist baron and papal chamberlain Luigi Parilli, was in 1948, quote, reportedly involved in a CIA operation to prevent a leftist victory in the Italian general elections. It was also rumored that he had concocted a plan to transport ex-Nazis from Germany to Paraguay. Continuing, as a knight of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, or SMOM, which issued its own diplomatic passports, Parilli was a member of an international Catholic network well-equipped to handle exfiltration. The leading Bavarian knight of Malta, Baron Erwine, E-R-W-E-I-N, von Eriten, A-R-E-T-I-N, was said to have arranged travel, quote, for no small number of ex-Nazis after the war. And Giovanni Battista Montini, the future Pope Paul VI, the OSS contact at the Vatican, did indeed become the patron of Bishop Hugo's exfiltration efforts. Quote, Montini had been under his supervision at the Vatican, beginning at, Montini had under his supervision the Vatican Bureau that issued the refugee travel documents and the Caritas Internationalis, the Church's international welfare organization, which was at this time and for some years after the war, one of the main charitable institutions aiding the fugitive Nazis, unquote. Like Parilli, Montini was later deeply involved in the CIA's first major post-war covert operation, the efforts to block a communist victory in the 1948 Italian election. We cannot in this article review the intricate contacts established throughout the war between the Nazis and the papacy and the United States, and the U.S. and Germany. However, the common denominator in such informal contacts became the post-war future of Europe and possible joint measures to exclude the Soviet Union from it. This was especially true after Churchill and Roosevelt had proclaimed the policy of unconditional surrender at Casablanca, a policy which not only dismayed Alan Dulles, but threatened the propriety of his continued contacts with members of the German opposition. Yet even after the failure of the July 1944 plot against Hitler, the OSS continued its increasingly questionable liaisons, now chiefly with representatives of SS leaders Himmler and Walter Schellenberg. One move before these contacts was clearly to limit the post-war influence in Western Europe of Soviet power, communist resistance forces, and the civilian communist parties. Another, however, appears to have been to prevent the post-war breakup of German and U.S. intelligence assets, and particularly the Galen networks in Eastern and Central Europe, which by 1945 were under the control of Skorzeny and the SS, and the OSS itself, which by 1945 was facing increasingly public attack inspired by U.S. military intelligence and the FBI. It is interesting to note that Galen knew of Karl Wolff's contacts with Dulles as early as January of 1945, the month in which they were initiated. From this same period, he began to consolidate his networks for survival after Hitler's downfall, which is to say, he already expected to reach a modus vivendi with the Americans. In April of 1945, 1 month before the war ended, Dulles asked Frank Wisner to begin talks with Galen, who was not taken into U.S. custody until May 20th. Note the timing here. And reading again. In April of 1945, 1 month before the war ended, Dulles asked Frank Wisner to begin talks with Galen, who was not taken into U.S. custody until May 20th. On the Galen side, a plan, quote, to gain contact with the Americans, unquote, was approved on April 4th and continued without interruption even after Hitler dismissed Galen on April 9th. Curiously, the Operation Sunrise contacts between Wolff and Dulles became most intense in the second half of April of 1945, even though at that time both Karl Wolff and Dulles knew they had no authority to negotiate a surrender. On April 17th, Wolff visited Berlin, where Galen and his headquarters were still located, to be told by Hitler personally that he should, quote, temporize in his talks with Dulles because it was still too early to consider a surrender or even negotiations, unquote. On the same day, Dulles returned to his Bern headquarters from the OSS European Theater headquarters in Paris to receive on April 21st, an April 17th order from the Combined Chiefs of Staff, quote, to liquidate Operation Sunrise by cutting off all contact with Karl Wolff, unquote. Undaunted by such orders, both men continued to negotiate, accompanied for the first time by a German army representative, Colonel von Schweinitz. Wolff came to Switzerland, counting on, quote, his personal reputation with the Anglo-Americans to extract guarantees from Dulles that the quote, idealistic, unquote, and decent, unquote, men of the Army, Party, and SS would be able to play, quote, an active part in the Reconstruction. We will continue with the conclusion of this article in our next program, overlapping the text. However, we are out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 1148, The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy, Part 3, being recorded on August 27th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.